Hello and welcome to the CHAM podcast. I'm your host, Heather Guyron-Fritz. This podcast is focused on bringing compassion, healing, awareness, and nurturing for your mind and body and soul. We hope to inspire new ways of thinking and motivation around a variety of topics and experiences, and we hope you'll come along for an episode and stay for the journey. Hello and welcome to the CHAM podcast. I am Heather Guyron-Fritz, and we have with us today Marcia Kristen. She is a certified trainer with the Center of Nonviolent Communication. Welcome, Marcia.
Hi, so glad to be here.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming. I have known Marcia since we were in middle school together. And over the years, she has gained great knowledge on nonviolent communication amongst many other disciplines. And I wanted to have her on the podcast today because I think that her work goes so hand in hand with what the CHAN project is doing. And she's going to dialogue with me today about nonviolent communication and the whole basis of that work, and how it can really center with the work that we're doing and a lot of the work that can go on in the world. So talk a little bit about nonviolent communication and maybe sort of about the beginning of this work and Marshall's work, if you could.
Oh, yeah. It feels so sweet to have an opportunity to share this. Nonviolent communication started with a man named Marshall Rosenberg, and he actually grew up in the Detroit area during the race riots. And he really noticed how there were places where there was violence and humans could be in that violent place in thoughts or words or actions. And then also like how compassionate, like his family was taking care of his grandmother. He grew up in the Jewish tradition and kind of went from there to explore how do we create lives that are better? And so we kind of went on a path as a psychologist and in healing work. And he got quite disillusioned, is my understanding, about the way we worked with people. And he was in psychiatric hospital, and he realized how much people were so needing empathy and presence and warmth and compassion. And it kind of emerged from there. He actually stopped psychology altogether and went on the road and began to look at what language does to support compassion, what different frameworks can help that while still being authentic. So it was from there that it really grew from there. Now there's 700 international trainers with the organization that are certified trainers. And then, you know, even more people that are practicing and sharing all over the world.
What drew you to this work?
I think like many of us, we see around us growing up how much healing is needed, you know, in family systems and greater systems, between people, between groups. So I was curious too, how do we evolve as humans enough to really live what we have the potential for? So I went on my way studying different things, but I think I came to it out of being a parent. I saw how my kids were kind of standing around waiting for me to tell them what they were doing wrong. Heartbreaking. I realized how much, you know, I wanted them to be okay in the world, and maybe what I was doing wasn't actually teaching them what I wanted to teach them. What I wanted them to have was a trust that we would have a relationship of trust where we could work through everything. And I had become a parent educator by that point, and learned lots of different modalities and working with, in a child abuse prevention agency and all kinds of things in school systems. And even with that, I realized I had not been taught how to work with emotions and how to increase my capacity to be with my emotions and another's emotions and work through communication. So it was quite jolting, shocking to have gone through all that exploration and be at that place. So I got drawn to nonviolent communication really by feeling it. I
Mm.
went to a parenting group and I got a ton of empathy for what it's like as a parent to love so completely and still have all the things that we kind of get handed down through our families and the culture. So it gave me a sense of self-awareness and connection that made me really want to integrate this in my life and for my family.
Can you give some of the examples without pouring your life story out as a mom? Can you give some examples of how parenting techniques, how you've used nonviolent communication techniques as a mom with your children?
Yeah, I think the biggest piece that maybe felt as if it was taking a long time to integrate, but was that ability to notice my own sort of nervous system, my own emotions, my own thoughts. So it helped me get some self-awareness and grounding so that I could be present with, you know, whatever disconnect or conflict or emotions or things that my kids were going through. So that was like the base, was that self-awareness, self-connection strategies. And then the more I was able to do that with myself, the more I could show empathy with them. And really, as together, we would then, as a partnership, kind of looking at their inner wisdom about it, their awareness, helping them to see the parts of themselves, what they were thinking, what they were feeling, what they were longing for that, you know, wasn't happening. So it was a way to support them in not only empathy for others, but empathy for themselves, like so that they could come to some grounding. And I have happened to have people in the world. I have three adult children, and a number of them are highly sensitive or feel the world and maybe have places where they don't always have a sense of belonging. So that seems super essential to be able to support them and being understanding themselves and understanding others at the same time.
So for someone who's coming new into this, maybe listening to this podcast and hearing nonviolent communication as a term for the first time, how would you describe the practices of nonviolent communication to somebody?
Yeah, oh, always challenging, but
because the terminology,
yes.
When I think about the term nonviolent communication, might not quite say what it really is.
Yeah, I love that piece because it is confusing. Nonviolent communication is often shortened to NVC, and yet grammatically it doesn't make a ton of sense because nonviolence is one word. So it's that sense of ahimsa, what nonviolence means. No enemy in my heart towards myself or another, or at least that's my best understanding of translation for that transcript word. Nonviolent communication is I heard someone say a spiritual practice that's masquerading as a communication tool. So it's kind of both. It has a different way of looking at the world that is a little bit outside of the blaming, judgmental culture that seems to be a part of our human brains. And it's also got a model. So it's kind of those two things. It's got like a map or a framework or training wheels that can help us stay in alignment with those values of our interconnectedness, compassion, while also having authenticity. So I like both those pieces, that it has some principles and things that help with that consciousness, and then it has a form, so like an essence and a form. And so it's a number of things that can seem very simple and at the same time quite complex.
Mm-hmm. And then how does, like when we've spoken in the past, how does that model and map help people to get to a space where they really can have compassion both for self and others. Because I think about people who are those individuals who might find themselves, might find their way to the Chan Project, or might find their way in listening to the Chan podcast. They are often, or they may be, individuals who find it difficult to love themselves or find it difficult to love others who have hurt them very deeply. How can the model of nonviolent communication help them to both love themselves, which may also help them to be able to forgive and love others?
Oh, such a great question, such a big question in some ways. What I think my answer would be to that is the map to me helps me fall back on something. I have a framework to fall back on when it's most challenging. So it helps for us to have that pause to observe, that mindfulness, that I can come back to choice. So I can observe, I can notice, you know, what are my thoughts? What are my judgments of myself or another? And then how do I want to translate those or pause with those and see what wisdom is there rather than being reactive? I want to be responsible. I want to be able to respond. So it has four parts to it. And I love it that those four parts we can apply in three ways. So it helps us observe is the first step. Like the number one piece is observations of noticing our body, coming back to our bodies, which are so challenging if we've been through trauma or just lived this life. So many judgments. So we can observe our thoughts and our judgments, observe our feelings, and we can increase our capacity to be with those feelings by looking at the third step, which is looking at universal human needs and then making requests that might support those needs. So that's the four parts. And each of those have so many things within them that we can kind of integrate and upgrade the way we work with our brains that we have, our fight, flight, and freeze, and all the meaning that our minds make. We are meaning-making machines. Our brains are meant to predict. Our brains are made to look at what's wrong. So even knowing that, anyone, especially those particularly struggling with really difficult things in life, as a lot of us do, that helps us know that we don't judge ourselves. We are all going to have judgmental minds because we need to figure out what's wrong in any moment. What we can do is work with that, thankfully. Notice what emotions we have because they're telling us something. To me, it's emotional intelligence exaggerated. Like it is the most, to me, amazing emotional intelligence I can have. My feelings are not good nor bad. They are. They're like weather systems. And when weather systems come in, we look out and we go, oh, do I need my umbrella? Oh, it's cold, you know, or it's sunny, you know, and we know what's going on. So if we can look at our feelings as neither good nor bad, it's just whether our needs are met, then maybe we have feelings we enjoy. Maybe needs aren't met and they're feelings that we don't enjoy. And then we can really look at what is it that I'm longing for? And what is somebody else? What's up for them? Kind of slow down and go deeper to be able to go faster, in a sense, to really get to the root of it. I think for some people to even have the concept that we all share universal human needs, that everything we say or do is at our best attempt to meet a need with the resources we have, internal and external. And just that, I will see people just like light bulbs go off, like what?
Yeah.
Because we're taught needs are either, you're either selfless and you take care of everyone else's needs at the expense of yours, or selfish and you take your needs at the expense of everyone. It's like we actually can hold all the needs with care.
Mm-hmm.
Find ways to really support, you know, like life amazing. And to deal with suffering, to really look at suffering and the ways that we cope. You know, maybe that strategy isn't such a great way to meet that need. So it's
And that makes me think, you know, I think about how our culture often feelings and emotions are so often they're poo-pooed and they're buried and we don't want to. I think about how as a child, my father, who was Filipino, we were not allowed to show emotions. We were not allowed to be too happy or too sad or too joyous. We could just sort of flatline our emotions. And then I remember the story that you told me about the workshop you were doing in the prison at Purdy. And the woman that was, she was using heroin, and you had asked her questions and then you had moved on. And all of a sudden she had this epiphany. Will you share that story? Because that was so powerful to hear someone who had an addiction and her reaction to the positive feelings that the substance gave her and then the realization. So share that story if you could.
Yeah, I started volunteering at the women's prison in Purdy and also the one at Mission Creek, I think in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So we bring in nonviolent communication and mindfulness training. And I was supporting the nonviolent communication, and we would bring in all kinds of things that we would do. And what I realized more than anything wasn't what I taught, it was the presence that we had, right? And that leaning into that place that when people have enough empathy, their wisdom comes. Mm-hmm. So she and I were paired up, and she had a huge amount of regret. She had, I think this was, you know, multiple times that she had come back into the prison system, which is very challenging to get out of. And her parents had been dealers, is what she was saying, that they had sold heroin. So she had been exposed to that as a very young person. And she was feeling so ashamed and felt so guilty about how could she could see the impact of that environment. And then she was repeating it, and she felt very down on herself. So many needs not met for integrity and care for others, care for her own well-being. She was separated from her children. It was heartbreaking. And we were looking at feelings and needs cards, and she was laying them out, and she was looking at them, and all of a sudden she's like, oh my gosh, I know what need heroin meets for me. The strategy of heroin, she separated it. She's like, the strategy of heroin for me, I feel so alive. I feel creative. I feel it's possibility. It helps me have hope. And I was like, wow, I'd never heard it in that way. And I thought, oh no, you know, she never gonna let that strategy go if it meets all those needs. And she just looked straight at me and said, I can meet those needs in other ways. She was like, done. She was just like, I don't need that. I can actually get those needs met with better strategies that cares for my family, cares for my well-being. I didn't say anything. I mean, this emerged.
It's just an epiphany. Mm-hmm.
Because she had a moment to just, without judgment, have just look for herself. What were her feelings? What were the needs that she was trying to meet? What needs were met and what wasn't? And of course, she needed support to go there, but she knew her intention. And I wish so much I knew what happened to her. But it felt like a gift that I could have that learning for myself along with
right.
It gave me a very different view. So it was a great contribution to me.
Yes.
You know, for her too. Yeah, that was very powerful. I remember another trainer telling me a story about the men's prison, how after learning nonviolent communication, he looked at the trainer and said, well, if I had known this before, I wouldn't have killed my best friend. And I wouldn't be here. I was like, wow. And so with that came this compassion for the guilt he held. He could mourn that he wished so much he would have had skills to work with his anger. That has stayed with me.
Oh, that's very heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. And in such a punitive system, you know, where so many people I've seen in the women's prison that are there from the war on drugs in the 80s and have 25-year sentences. And it's hoping that, that prisons could become more of a house of healing, or we could find other ways to keep people safe and to also work on the things we need to work on to support well-being for ourselves and others. But those are the moments that really show me how powerful this work is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you see it being used? I know we touched on this a little bit, but one of the things that you had noted about was making sure that we mentioned blame in or blame out, habits of judgment. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that was so expanding for my mind to learn that I wasn't the only one who had judgments in so strongly. I really honestly thought something, I was broken because I had so many. And then to learn is like, oh, that's the way we're wired. That was a huge epiphany. And then to know that I can take those judgments, that instead of that sense of, oh, just don't be judgmental. Yeah, great. How's that going to go? To know that I can pause and to use that map of NVC is that I can take those, notice my judgments. I don't have to believe them. And then I can look at, okay, underneath that judgment, what am I feeling? And then what is it that's important? That universal human need, which is usually something that everybody can longs for, helps them thrive, not just survive, you know, survival needs, but thriving needs. So to know that we can take that judgment that's going in or out for that matter and translate it. And we can even practice that. Do you want to practice it? Or you want to see what it feels like?
Sure. I'm game.
This is something that I do that I think is a fun thing to play with, is you can take like one judgmental statement that you have, like one sentence, and you want to pick something that's not like the most extreme judgment you have, so that we learn in this moment, you know, in practice. So an example might be, it's like, they're always late, you know, or they don't care, you know, one of those kinds of things.
And what I can say that I'm always late.
It may be true in some way. I can take that judgment, but, or I can be like, one of mine is, I can't do math.
Okay.
Or especially, I can't do math in public or whatever. Or which kind of the meaning I begin to make of it is, I'm stupid. Which, like, ooh, that's a harsh judgment, right? That might be underlying unconscious. So if I take that, okay, so I notice it. I like observe. This is the thought I'm having. I can slow down and say, is it true? You know, is it 100% true? Not actually. Okay. But I also want to just like take a breath. Okay, those are my thoughts. I'm having a thought. I'm telling myself this sentence. Okay. Then I can take a breath. How do I feel when I actually say in my head to myself, I'm always late, I'm a bad mom, or whatever it might be? Well, I feel sad, I feel discouraged, my heart hurts, my chest kind of hurts, my jaw is tight, maybe it's harder to breathe. And so I can leave kind of some breath to be with that feeling without being scared of it. I might feel sad. I might feel angry. And then I can take a breath and say, okay, what am I longing for? What are those feelings pointing towards? Well, when I say I'm always late and I feel sad and disappointed and guilty, maybe even some shame, I can notice I'm really longing to be predictable. I'm longing to contribute. I really value reliability. I really long to be considerate. I love consideration. So it's like you take that judgment statement and you switch it into an I love it when statement. I love it when I can arrive at an agreed upon time because that gives me a sense of living in integrity. Or I love it when I have consideration for my time and others. Or I love to show care. I'm getting to the need again and again. And I'm like, oh, okay, so how do I want to actually live in alignment with those values of care? And what kind of support do I need? Maybe it's really challenging for me. Maybe I get distracted and it's hard for me to care for the clock that doesn't match my inner clock, you know, or something. You know, or life, you know, that maybe I want some compassion for how much I want to give. And, you know, so it's following that. If we stay just in the judgment, either in or out, you can really feel in your body that that doesn't really support our well-being.
Yes.
And I can be responsible that say, like, wow, I notice that I'm later than I wish I was a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And I really long for to live consideration, have consideration for my own things that I'm juggling and for others. And so what are the requests I can make to myself or to others to help support me in living those needs that I identified? So it's very empowering to get to those.
And being things. Kinder.
Yes. And I'm not letting go of what impact, what needs I'm not meeting, but I'm also holding really strongly the needs of my intention. And I'm willing to hear feedback if the strategies I'm picking are not working for others.
Mm-hmm.
What needs they have. So it increases our capacity to negotiate, to communicate with each other, to be heard without blaming. Because we're so...
I like that. I hear a lot of times the courses that I teach... Students are required to write quite a bit in quite a few of my courses. And I repeatedly hear students, there's always at least a few students that complain that they are horrible writers. And so I'm always teaching them affirmations and to use affirmations to be better writers and to just practice writing, to read and to read and to write and to read and to write and to read and to write, and that will help them to become better writers. But I had never thought of this as a practice to become more forgiving of yourself, and in forgiving of yourself, that also could be a tool for becoming a better writer, or at the least getting through your degree without hating having to write your papers.
It's something that's so, our culture is so aligned with judgments, either good or bad, either or. And this is about taking us out of that paradigm of right and wrong and going to our needs met or not met.
Mm-hmm.
Even a positive judgment we think of as a good thing. And yet positive judgments are still judgments. It's external.
Yes.
Even if I said, you're a good speaker or something, I can translate that into, okay, as a speaker, I've done something that's contributed to that person.
Mm-hmm.
So I can even translate a positive judgment into what needs have been met.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so powerful to be able to translate those judgments and be able to speak in ways instead of saying, oh, Heather, you're such a good person. I could say, Heather, when I see this Chan project, or I see the classes, or I see the way you are with somebody, I could give an observable. I feel touched I feel inspired. I have a sense of contribution and I learn from you. That's way more specific feedback. You know, if I can follow that same model to express my appreciation, or I can use that same model to express something that's not working for me. It's so much more likely for that person to sink in when it's connected to needs. And that
I was really surprised when you said to me the other day, and I've thought about it a lot, when you said that everybody judges, that it is a very natural human process, that we all have judgments. It doesn't matter how good or how bad or how positive or how negative of a human being we are. It is a human natural response to judge people and to judge situations. And I can't tell you, Marcia, how much relief that gave me. Because I remember when I told you that I judge that part of me that I judge. And I sometimes get at myself that how the heck am I judging that situation? And when you told me it is a natural human trait to judge, and we just all do it, I just went, oh my gosh, I wish someone had told me that 40 years ago that everybody makes judgment.
And that what's amazing to me is humans are so wired and have amazing brains, you know, which is a cause of judgment in a sense, but we have brains that can actually hold complex things. We can translate it.
Yes.
Usable information. And that our minds and our hearts and our culture does get hooked by that negativity bias. There's some amazing mindfulness teachers, that you probably know that speak about that negativity bias, that our brains are wired to be Velcro for the bad and then Teflon for the good. In other words, you know, it slides right off. And I think Marshall Rosenberg saw that too. He saw that our language was so judgment, either or, right, wrong, really good.
Yes.
And that our culture emerged from there. And that's why violence happens. Violence happens towards ourselves or another when there isn't connection and understanding to the feelings and the needs. And so once we can take that judgment and we actually work with it, because judgments are there to keep us alive. We have to discern for our survival. We don't want to get rid of that ability to discern. We just need to tweak the discernment.
Right.
And tweak it to our needs being met or not. I think that's what the woman in the prison saw. She was just like, she saw it through a needs lens rather than a right, wrong, good, bad lens. And that was like, whoa, we can be so much, we can meet so many more needs when we can not judge ourselves for our judgments. And we're just piling judgments upon judgments. So feels very liberating to me, to find other ways towards compassion.
So how is empathy taught? If a person is not born as an empathetic person, how do we teach empathy?
Yeah. It's a great question, because what even is empathy? But I mean, empathy, as far as I'm understanding it from many people who have studied this for a long time, Carl Rogers is one who Marshall Rosenberg studied with, but empathy is that place of being able to like completely empty your heart, as Thich Nhat Hanh used to say, that really get, you're gotten at a deep level. There's resonance. So we are all thankfully born with the ability to feel with. We have mirror neurons, we attune, that we are meant as social beings. So thankfully it's in us, and all we have to do is kind of actually unlearn this blame culture, and then we're good. So but a lot of that piece of empathy is that if we can connect with the feelings and needs, actually the best way to learn empathy is to receive it. We immerse each other in that place of presence, willingness to connect and be curious. Why'd you do what you did? You know, what were you feeling in that moment? If I can guess the feelings and the needs of someone else and have it be a guess, and they get to tell me if that, you know, fits or that seems to be true for them, that's empathy happening. Where if even if I'm listening with no words coming out of my mouth and all I'm listening for is their feelings, their emotions, and what needs they were trying to meet, what needs they met or didn't meet, that right there is an empathic space.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, well, what I've noticed again and again is I could certainly teach it, but when I was in the, I was in elementary school teaching a kindness curriculum is what I was supposed to be teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I was learning MVC and that I decided to learn with them. They, once they were immersed in it, they got it in about 1 second.
Oh,
because
little brains
were given empathy for the first time rather than told what they were doing wrong.
Oh,
but praise, which is just the flip side of negative judgment. And to watch these beings, and I would come home with my own children, you know, and I'd, okay, I'm going to do this. And then I would be like, how come I can't do this? I needed to be immersed in empathy for me to be able to empathize with myself and others when, you know, I got really hot. And now I look at my kids, and because they thankfully grew up at least with a little bit of empathy eventually that I learned, it's part of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's, they know what it feels like. So to me, it's about offering those places of empathy and having people just experience it.
That's beautiful.
It's,
and kindness with the little ones. That's really something that it can be gotten in just a minute.
Oh, because think of how punitive it is wherever they go.
Mm-hmm.
The second mm-hmm. day, oh my gosh, were you feeling really scared? And you mm-hmm. you jumped out in front of the car to get your ball. It was like, that must have been really scary.
Yeah.
You wanted to care for something that had been given to you. Yeah, and I'm scared too. Let's stay over here or whatever. You know, how do we
mm-hmm.
how do we really come in and guess someone's feelings and needs?
Yes, and our little ones are, they're just such sponges. And I think about the negative reinforcement versus positive reinforcement and how our culture has so often taken mm-hmm. on negative reinforcement as punishment yeah. for children. And
for human.
And then we look at the what yeah. I believe is the correlation of substance abuse and mental health needs and emotional wellness that has fallen into the gutters. And we wonder why. And I really believe that it correlates with that negative reinforcement that punishment has gone on for children.
And
our prison systems. And you know, we don't have a rehabilitative prison system. We don't have positive reinforcement for people who make mistakes. It's punishment for people who make mistakes.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing about MVC to me and other things mm-hmm. that do this, that instead of punishment being a motivator, that we understand that human motivators are actually human needs.
Yes.
We are motivated to meet human needs, all of those things, trust, belonging, community, consideration, kindness, respect, all the human needs.
Mm-hmm.
Those are our motivators. And if we start to see that punishment is not the place that actually helps us grow. When we're connected to the needs that we're meeting or not meeting, we are motivated to support those needs just naturally. We as, mm-hmm. as humans are motivated mm-hmm. when their own needs are considered and then they can consider the needs of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall had a great thing. He asked, what do you want someone to do differently? And the second question is, what do you want the reason to be? Do you want it to be coercion, fear, threat of punishment, guilt, shame, promise of reward? Or do you want them to be connected to the value that that it meets? So I was like, oh my gosh.
Connected to the value that it meets. Wouldn't that always be the reason?
Yeah, because that's so much more motivating. Coercion. That was pretty amazing to me to see how it doesn't matter how long you've been on this earth. Once you hear, you're moved by, you know, the needs that might be met for somebody or the needs that haven't been met. You know, there's remorse that comes. There's regret just naturally comes. And you want.
It's interesting because as you were saying that, all of those first choices came from anger and fear for me. And then the only choice was love. The last choice was the only offer for love. And if you love someone.
I mean, because like if you, yeah, if you came to me and said, here, I'm feeling concerned, I'm hurt, and I'm really wanting to long to have some care and consideration, I'd be like, oh, of course I'd like to do that. And if my needs be considered too, be like, well, I would love to do that. And this is what I'm challenged by. I would really love to contribute. And I've also heard and seen that I'm doing the best I can or whatever. Oh my gosh. Then it's like, we can find ways to hold needs with care. So instead of our intention being, let's find out what's wrong and punish it. How about what's going to make life more wonderful for all? And we can mourn when we can't find it. We can mourn together and say, I long so much for you to have well-being and to find a way of coping to de-escalate your stress with a strategy that also cares for your well-being. And I'm not sure what that's going to look like, but I do hold that, you know, we can set compassionate boundaries. And I think it goes really, it really supports restorative processes to have NBC kind of consciousness and model. It links a lot into restorative processes and in healing,
yes.
You know, between people, but healing within yourself, between people, and also big systemic healing, you know. For marginalized groups that have been, you know, othered, where violence has happened. And it's a very.
I love that you teach this for a variety of settings. You know, you teach it at the corporate setting, and you teach it, like you said, for marginalized groups, and you know, you're going to partner with the Chan Project, and I just think that you know, we talked the other day, and I said that I'm one of those eternal learners. I'll learn and go to workshops and until the day I die, probably. But I truly believe that, you know, we use such a minuscule, teeny, teeny, tiny part of our brains, and we know so little. And tools like this, like learning about nonviolent communication and learning about empathy and heck, just learning that we all judge and it's okay to judge. And it's what I continue to think about that judgment and what I do with that judgment that really counts and really, really decides what type of a human I am. But that, you know, we're never too old to keep learning, and we're never too old to keep dialoguing with people that have different opinions than ours. And that by learning these new techniques and these beautiful new abilities to grow our minds and to grow our mindfulness and to grow into ourselves and allow our spirits to blossom and grow and think new creative ways is what's going to open our universe and our world to be more open and welcoming and universal. You know, there's got to be more love, because I will always believe that we are more alike than we are different. We are so much more alike than we are different on this planet. And it doesn't matter, you know, what our gender or our religion or the state or country we live in. I really believe we are more alike than we are different. And if we could come together and learn to communicate and connect,
I agree.
It'd just be such a more beautiful, welcoming place.
Yeah, I agree. I think Marshall really had a hope for it to really make systemic change, because we don't conflict at the level of human needs. We can conflict at the level of strategies we use, but we all have the same human needs, just like you're saying. And I think it's a beautiful thing to know how do we work with that? How do we bring that into our everyday lives? So,
I think we all need love. I think love is really the basic foundation that each and every one of us need. And some of us just go about it in safer, easier ways. And then some of us need it so desperately that we go about it in really dangerous ways.
Yeah. And then those times when we're acting most tragically to meet our needs is the time
when we need it most.
We need empathy the most.
Yeah. It really is.
So I'm with you with the continually wanting to evolve and learn and grow, and excited for the project and for what it's bringing forth and bringing together. So,
well, thank you, Marsha. How can our listeners get a hold of you?
Yeah, let's see. My website is compassionate-language.com. And my email is Marcia, which is M-A-R-C-I-A, at compassionatelanguage.com. And that's also nonviolent communication. You can Google, you can look on YouTube, you can look on Instagram. You know, all those resources are there. CNVC.org is the Center for Nonviolent Communication, which I said is international, and almost every country in the world. And you can find more information there, maybe find someone near you if you're listening to this from outside the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, and I would love to support in any way I can.
Perfect. Well, thank you for joining us today, Marcia, and thank everybody for tuning in. And Marcia will be back with us in the future because she is such a wealth of knowledge. So everybody have a wonderful day. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Chan Podcast. We appreciate you joining us and hope so much that you gained insight. We invite you to share with us what you enjoy about the episode and all of our stories, what you would like to hear more about, and to share your opinions and interests. Please glance over our show notes and be sure to check out the episode's blog, where you actually get a chance to dialogue with the Chan Project team and our guests directly. You can find this at chanproject.org/podcast, and then just select the show you tuned into. You can find all of our episodes on this same page and our full list of programs on chanprogram.org. Namaste, Heather and the Chan Podcast family.